From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. We've got a big week now that Memorial Day is in our rearview mirror, and hope everyone had a respectful day for the meaning of the day off that we all had. I was very happy to be out there with WOKV, our local affiliate in Jacksonville. They do an unbelievable thing. I don't know if you've been to Jaguar Stadium. They got this huge wall, second only in size to the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C., and they have all the branches of the government represented and the military represented out there. And also, kind of fascinated by this. Turns out the American people like the fact that gas is $3.08 on average. 45 million travelers Memorial Day weekend. As gas gets low and then people hit the streets, that is an all-time record. So now I hope you beat some traffic and are ready to go. So let's go to the big three.
Number three.
I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. We're in the middle of talking and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all. Something happened to this guy, and I don't like it.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is the same guy. He's getting worse. You're right, Mr. President, but it is the same guy. Putin, you're about to have your only off-ramp closed. Trump explodes while Russia bombs, while the president could do now to make Putin pay a steeper price for the war he'd started.
Number two.
Donald Trump brought millions of voters into the Republican Party by promising to cut taxes on tips, cut taxes on overtime, cut taxes on Social Security. He has to deliver for those voters, and he's going to deliver for those voters. Everything else is negotiable.
Well, we'll see. The Senate now has it. We'll see where this goes. The House delivers a big, beautiful bill, and the Senate pledges to change it. We got Rand Paul, Tom Tillis, Ron Johnson, all on different pages. Next.
Number one.
Presidents get surrounded by people who have a vested interest in keeping that president propped up. So that's the only reason we invoke Watergate, is just to make clear, like, it's not Watergate. Right. This is an entirely separate scandal, maybe even worse.
Yes, Jake Tapper. And I know you're just pretending to realize it now and you're making a ton of money. So good for you. And I'm being sarcastic. It's not letting up. The steady stream of facts about Joe Biden's invisibility and disability are flooding forward. And the scandal further hamstrings the Democratic Party as a familiar name emerges as a contender to drag them from the left to the center. Good luck with that. And by the way, if you ever want to get the app, go do it. Get the Fox News app and you get our podcast, which is just a straight hour. Tom Carrico is coming up a little bit later to break down what's happening in Russia. But I want to break down what's happening with the breakdown of President Biden. Now, we knew this in 2019, 2020. We watched him on the debate stage. You and I brought it up. I took calls. How could this guy possibly get the nomination? You saw him being mocked on SNL. And all of a sudden, after South Carolina, up comes Jim Clyburn, and he gets the nomination, goes right to the basement. Now we found out that was intentional because the guy couldn't get a sentence out, couldn't conduct a town hall, couldn't even do a speech, couldn't do an interview without a teleprompter, and they just beat Trump, and they just worried about it when they got the job. Well, he got the job. And then you had the press watching his back and for 4 years. And it turns out the new conclusion is the Politburo, as they're called in the book, and I think it's pretty accurate, protected him. And I'm not talking about cabinet secretaries. Hunter Biden, Jill Biden, a guy named Bruce Reed, who I don't know, Steve Ricchetti, who you saw all around him, and Mike Donilon predominantly were the ones who watched his back, along with Ron Klain, who was there a while and still was holding influence early. It's just insane that we let this happen. It's insane that the Democrats didn't even ask a question in the press room. You heard Peter Ducey come out and say that I'd get groans every time I would ask a question about the president's cognitive ability or lack thereof. Alex Thompson, the co-author, said this about the effort to deceive. Cut two.
They weren't telling the truth. And I think the book really conclusively shows what was going behind the scenes. And throughout 2023 and 2024, there were steps taken to increasingly shield Joe Biden, not just from the public, but from, you know, members of his own cabinet, members of his own senior staff. And one White House official who left in 2024 told us that they left in part because they were not comfortable with how they were trying to shield the extent of the decline. Joe Biden that people saw on that debate stage, I think the book really shows it was not the first time that Joe Biden had acted like that.
Okay, a couple of things. I said it at the time. Why was he debating in June? I mean, why did he all of a sudden make that announcement while Trump was embroiled in the New York trial, which was a sham, but it resulted in a conviction? And then he had the $450 million that he has to pay back on the civil trial and E. Jean Carroll. Nobody was calling on a debate from Joe Biden, but out of nowhere, he says, I want to debate you. In an awkwardly written teleprompter speech, he says, I hear you have Wednesdays off. So he says, I'm going to pick the venue. I'm going to pick the format without a live audience. I'm going to pick I think he even picked the moderators. I'm not sure. And he says, I want you to agree to one in June and one in September. Now, knowing what we know that they knew about Biden and that they were making a massive effort to conceal it, somebody wanted him out there exposed. Somebody wanted the truth to get out. That's why he did it. Joe Biden, clueless on his cognitive ability. He really is. I mean, I don't know if that's typical with people in his condition. And I'm not talking about the devastating cancer, which he obviously had at the time. But who put him out there? And why wasn't Jill able to stop it? Why wouldn't Jill just do pull Nancy Reagan? Go, no, we're not debating at all. Donald Trump is not worthy. He's a convicted, whatever you wanted to make up. Somebody wanted him exposed. Where I think the plan fell apart was when it became clear that Kamala Harris had to get the nomination and it would not be a jungle primary where they'd give somebody else a chance to step up. That's what I think is amazing about this as yet to be told. Now, it's amazing how many Democrats are coming out. And I don't want to take too much time because I want to get to Tom and I want to get to the breakdown of what happened with Russia. And I think the president's at a turning point over the weekend. But I'm just fascinated by the Democrats. This is something usually happens in November, December, January. But by May of the next year, which we're in now, usually that party that lost in November is ready to go. Remember Scott Brown, after Obama wins big over John McCain, beats Ted Kennedy and gets that Senate seat. And everyone said, uh-oh. Then in comes the Tea Party and the massacre at the midterms with 60-plus seats. And, you know, already Obama, with all his popularity and charisma, was on his heels. They are still trying to figure out if there is a Democratic Party, and to a degree. You got Kamala Harris, who, by the way, is in Australia. She gave a speech. She's getting paid a ton of money. Goes out there and speaks to some insurance company. She made absolutely no sense. Listen to this. She spoke at length about issues important to her and launched into a lengthy word salad when asked about humility, which, by the way, was an interesting question. I don't aspire to be humble. I don't recommend it. I think that's one must be humble. But to aspire to be humble would be quite inauthentic, he said. If one understands that, there's so much that is magnificent and awe-inspiring about this world and its people. That's verbatim. I mean, that's what Joe Biden left to go beat Donald Trump, the most formidable force the Republican Party maybe has ever seen. If you look at the movement that's going to go past him and that started with him. So listen to John Lovett. He's part of the Obama tribe, former writer for Obama, Pod Save America, Cut 7, with John Stewart.
We went to the White House and saw Joe Biden, who had just come back from a trip, and he was, I don't think it wasn't as I think, egregious as what you hear in the audio around the Hur report.
This was April of 2020.
It was April, and he was rambling, and he was hard to follow, and he repeated a story. But then we were assured by people around him that he was just exhausted. I remember feeling, I want to talk about this as a huge liability. I want to talk about this as something Joe Biden can overcome. But I'm not going to go so far as to say, I think Joe Biden must drop out. He is too old to be president. A, because I didn't know exactly what was going on behind the scenes. But B, if Joe Biden is the candidate, I want him to win because right. I care about the country.
Okay. That's not your job. Just tell me what you think. If you're the host of a podcast, I guess your overall objective is to Democrats to win. That's not why I do this show. That's not why I do Fox and Friends or One Nation on the weekend. It's not my job to make sure that Donald Trump wins or Joe Biden loses. Just report. I just saw what Joe Biden did. Your first responsibility is to your audience. I met with Joe Biden. It's really disturbing. I know he's old, but I know 78-year-olds that are much more on top of things than he is. I'm wondering if he could run again. And if you say that early enough, then people other than Dean Phillips gets to run in the primaries. And RFK Jr. doesn't get ramrodded out of there. And other people step up and Governor Beshear and others get in there. It's not your job. You know, I could see being loyal to Barack Obama, if Barack Obama called up and said, do me a favor, but I don't even know where he's coming from. He's basically just saying, I have a podcast, make sure Joe Biden wins and Donald Trump loses. Insane. 1-866-408-7669. So Tom Caracco is next. I want to get his take on what's going on in Russia. Not good. Nowhere is Iran. We're making progress with those talks. I'm telling you right now, the talks are a waste of time. And the only thing that Vladimir Putin understands is force and sanctions and spending his $300 billion. I'll prove that. That's exactly where both storylines are heading. And Hamas also. Turns out not trustworthy. Who would have thought? Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
China's financing this war. They're buying Russian oil at reduced prices. So is India. And they're supposed to be an ally of ours, obviously. Yeah, there's plenty we can do here with secondary sanctions. And I think going after the central bank is something we should have done right from the beginning. Yes, we can hurt Putin. I'm not suggesting we can't. He's just not as intimidated by them as other people are.
And by the way, that was General Jack Keane. So he understands Trump. He understands the frustration he felt over the last 4 years. And he understands with the Biden administration. Now we know that Joe Biden wasn't even making the decisions. Not that would have helped because he's gotten everything wrong his entire career. But he does have experience. But Russia has directed over 1,390 drones, 94 missiles at targets across Ukraine. According to the Ukrainian Air Force, the attacks killed 30 just over the last few days. Just over the last few days. At the same time, Trump is putting his personal reputation and prestige behind getting these two sides to talk and not feeling bad about going to a traditional ally and letting Zelensky have it, famously in the Oval Office. And then Zelensky foolishly comes out over the weekend and says, oh, Donald Trump or the America should say more about this. I mean, when is he going to learn? Just knock it off. I'm a fan of his. I understand what he's going through, but you don't need to go on social media and say something. You could pick up the phone and talk to the president and say, what is your plan? Now, the president expressed deep frustration over the weekend, walking to the plane. Cut 16.
I'm not happy with what Putin's doing. He's killing a lot of people, and I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. We're in the middle of talking, and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all. Something happened to this guy, and I don't like it.
Right. He doesn't like it. So, Mr. President, there's a few things you could do. Start immediately sanction the central bank. Number two, what General Keane was looking into, what was he intimating, was you give 30-party sanctions. Hey, India, Modi just broke up a war between you and Pakistan. You are single-handedly sustaining Russia. Now, you feel loyalty to Russia because of your rivalry with China. I understand not the world is not simple, but as long as you buy the discount oil from Russia and not from us or other customers, Saudi Arabia, you pick it, we're going to hit you with sanctions for every barrel of oil you buy. Same thing with you, China. I know we're at basically a trade war. It could get worse, but we know what you're doing. We know that you said you would not give them anything that's even dual use, and you're giving them direct aid. And you got thousands of soldiers who evidently left China just to fight as mercenaries. I'm sure you had nothing to do with that. So this is, I think, what Trump did, took trade courage to come in and say, I'm going to try to broker a peace agreement. And to do that, I'm going to tick off some of our allies, but I'm going to take the lead here. The off-ramp is not taken by Russia. In fact, they've increased the intensity. And that, to me, is an insult. So, Mr. President, you have a few things you can do, and I think General Keane mapped it out pretty effectively. Cut 18.
China is financing this war. They're buying Russian oil at reduced prices. So is India. And they're supposed to be an ally of ours, obviously. Yeah, there's plenty we can do here with secondary sanctions, and I think going after the central bank is something we should have done right from the beginning. Yes, we can hurt Putin. I'm not suggesting we can't. He's just not as intimidated by them as other people are.
And here's what he went on to say. Cut 19. Okay, so that was, he went on to say that he has $300 billion in frozen assets in Europe. Instead of just giving the interest to Ukraine, give him the whole thing. The other thing that they're doing, led by Germany, and we have said that U.S. and all the EU and the NATO forces are with it. We are no longer having distance restrictions on the missiles we sent them. So if they want to go hit Moscow, go hit Moscow. We were worried about this escalating. Not anymore. Not after the Russians fired off 900 drones and 65 cruise missiles over the weekend. Now they need more patriots. You know what we've said? We'll get back to you because we have to keep patriots for ourselves. We have ally contracts. We don't have enough. I think Raytheon makes it, so we have to pick up the pace in making it and delivering it. And what Ukraine says is, I'm not asking for a gift. I will pay for it. And I agree. And my goodness, even if you want the war to end, and if you believe that Ukraine's wrong, whatever, you should not be against Patriot missiles, which are made to knock rockets out of the sky before they blow up things. So there's nothing offensive about it. But this new German Chancellor Merz is pretty interesting. He says no more range restrictions on Ukraine's use of weapons. They also promised to spend 2% on their military, first time since World War II. To date, Ukraine has only been able to use long-range missiles supplied by the countries against Russian troops within a certain range. Now, you got to back them off and do it. And keep in mind, the Russians had taken last year 18% of the country. This year, 20% of the country. They've lost about 800 to a million people, not all dead, but casualties off the battlefield. Here's what Peskov said, which I find really demeaning, personally. He's the Kremlin spokesperson. We are really grateful to the Americans and to President Trump personally for their assistance in organizing and launching the negotiation process. Of course, at the same time, this is a crucial moment, which is associated, of course, with the emotional overload of everyone absolutely and with emotional reactions. So as if to say, Donald Trump is so stressed, we understand he's not responsible for his actions. I love what Lindsey Graham posted. This latest outrage by Russia will not go unaddressed. Without China's support, Putin's war machine comes to a halt. Grassley said something similar. Over 70 votes in the Senate to sanction Russia big time. All the president has to do is sign it and not veto it. So let's do it. You use that as leverage to Putin. If you do not have a ceasefire, this goes into effect. It's going to get worse for you. Listen, the president's been extremely patient, 6 months in, not even, with Vladimir Putin. He's been very patient with Iran. He's been patient with Hamas. Witkoff bouncing back and forth. Feels like he's making progress, but nothing gets done. I fundamentally think, Steve Witkoff seems like a fine guy, but I fundamentally think you have to know people that know the history, the people they're dealing with, and with their countries. I'm not sure that he does. With all his connections and with all his success, I'm not sure he does. And I sense that if Marco Rubio would just take the lead on this and have other people with great knowledge of the region and the people that we're negotiating with, we're going to get to the same conclusion. Russia will only cease fire when they're forced to, and Iran can never, ever be trusted. Their goal is just delay of game, four corners offense, and then suddenly say, I have a nuclear weapon. What are you going to do about it? I never would believe them, even if they said they're no longer going to be enriching uranium. I just don't believe it. And within 3 months, if they allow inspectors in their country, if they allow the cameras, the first time we do something that they don't like or we don't like or we have some type of dispute, out go the weapons inspectors, down go the cameras, and then we're going to say, let's have talks. Don't think so. We learned how stupid that is. I think the president has given peace a chance. He promised no more Middle East wars. But, Mr. President, this has been coming since 1979. And we just supply the weapons to Israelis. They'll do the rest.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
In the campaign, I promised the American people that I would build a cutting-edge missile defense shield to protect our homeland from the threat of foreign missile attack. And that's what we're doing. Today, I'm pleased to announce that we have officially selected an architecture for this state-of-the-art system that will deploy next-generation technologies across the land, sea, and space, including space-based sensors and interceptors. This design for the Golden Dome will integrate with our existing defense capabilities and should be fully operational before the end of my term. So we'll have it done in about 3 years. Once fully constructed, the Golden Dome will be capable of intercepting missiles, even if they are launched from other sides of the world and even if they are launched from space.
So the President of the United States says, why is an Iron Dome protecting, actually need three weapon systems, protecting Israel? Why don't we have one for the United States? Well, that's impossible. Missile defense is impossible. Those would, that was some of the refrain when Donald Rumsfeld wanted to do it during the Bush 1 first administration, Bush 43. And now, of course, everyone laughed when Reagan said it. Now, I had a chance to get briefed on it when I went to Cheyenne in Denver into the mountain, to NORAD, and they said to me, it's absolutely possible. It's going to be costly, but possible. Here to talk about it is somebody that knows about this quite well. He is Tom Caracco, a big guest on the show, and he's a senior fellow of international security program, the director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Tom, how significant was the president's announcement last week?
Yeah, Brian, well, it certainly is possible. And I think the Oval Office announcement last week is a pretty important step. I think the part of the phrase that you quoted there was the selection of the architecture. So they're, you know, at this point, the Pentagon is going to be moving out on a specific frame of reference, specific things. You heard a couple things there in terms of sensors and interceptors. But we're going to see more details in the coming weeks with the submission of the president's budget request for FY26. But no, the bottom line is that this is way overdue, and you don't have to think any harder than just picking up the headlines of what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Israel or the Red Sea. Lots and lots of air and missile threats being used. The threshold for use is very low, and it's a high time that we have a measure of protection. It's not going to be perfect. No weapon system is perfect, but we need to have a measure of protection for some really critical points here in the United States.
All right. But you have to wonder about everything being ratcheted up. Like hypersonics 5 years ago was new. Now it seems like everyone's got them. Are we ready to block that? And what's next after that? So the thing is, there is people working on it from land, sea, and now space. Why do you think China is so hostile to it?
Well, it's actually, I think, a sign that it's the right thing to do. It's countering the threats that they are making. It's countering the things that China is developing and fielding to hold us at risk. And on a bad day, in a potential conflict, escalating, they would like to be able to hold us at risk, not merely our cities with various things, but infrastructure, our military points of departure, so that we can't flow forces to the other side of the world to help our allies that they may be picking on. So, of course, they don't like it. That's a sign that we're on to something.
The other thing I would say is we also have to pick up even more rudimentary defense operations like Patriots. We don't, Ukraine says, I'll pay for them. We say we don't have enough. We told our allies, you sell it to them, because we have enough for our country and for other contracts, but we're not building them fast enough.
I'll say that. Yeah, that's a big problem. We need. Fortunately, the U.S. Army is increasing the capacity rate of Patriot PAC-3 production, and that's a good thing. But right now there's 18 countries in the world that operate the Patriot system, and that we've got to get more capacity out. To Ukraine, yes, but to lots of other folks. I do think we ought to let Ukraine buy them. They've got the funds. We ought to be letting some contracts, even if it'll take a little while to get them there. And in no small part, I mean, look what happened over the weekend. This is the single largest air and missile attack in the Ukraine conflict, and it doesn't quite come to the numbers of the April 14 attack on Israel, but it's nevertheless a lot. I think it was something like 367 drones and missiles, and drones, these long-range drones, they're essentially cruise missiles of a sort, and it caused a lot of damage in Ukraine, and Russia's just escalating the war. I don't know why anybody thinks that there's a ceasefire. They're escalating.
All right, and the thing is, it's such an in-your-face, too, to escalate, not even pretend as if you're de-escalating. But you go ahead and say, yeah, those talks, not only that, I have no sincerity in those talks, and here's my answer to it. So they bombarded the Ukraine with drones and cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. Ballistic missiles, they say, are giving them the biggest problems. Now, when it comes to the drones, they're looking to exhaust their missile defense with the drones, right?
Yeah, with everything. And they're doing it in structured attacks where you got drones and ballistic missiles coming in at the same time. And there's only so many things a radar can look for and track at the same time. And so it is it can be overwhelming to a defense. Every weapon system, again, is finite. And this is, on a larger strategic level, it's a mockery of the, perhaps well-meaning effort on the part of the U.S. administration to get a ceasefire, but the Russians have no interest in that. They want a conclusion of the conflict through victory and the subjugation of Ukraine. And I think, we, the Europeans, are coming around to the recognition that that's what they're up to. I think it's truly remarkable. The Germans, they have a new chancellor who's a lot better than the last guy on this question. And he's saying he's releasing range restrictions on things that they've sold to or given to Ukraine. That would be good. I hope that the Germans also follow up with, say, some Taurus cruise missiles, because the only way to limit Russia here is to not force Ukraine to have a hand tied behind their back. And to
you mean like they have been for 2 years? Don't use HIMARS. You're not going to get them. You got HIMARS. Don't use ATACMS. You're not going to get them. Now you can use them. Right. But you don't have restrictions on them. Remember, they weren't going to give them Patriot missiles either. And they ended up getting it to them. It's unbelievable how much harder we have made things for the Ukrainians, who I know that they are fighting for us, because believe me, the Baltics are next.
Yeah, look, our last two national defense strategies have agreed on one thing: the Trump first national defense strategy and the Biden one. They both agreed on the basic principle that Russia and China is our biggest problem, and the strategic utility here is to not allow Russia's adventurism and also to degrade them and punish them so as to deter further adventurism. To your point, Brian. And furthermore, and there's a new report out exactly on this topic, is yes, what happens in Ukraine does have a bearing, for better or worse, on what happens or doesn't with China. We've increased our production of some weapon system. That's good, but Russia's still smoking us on overall weapon production. So we've been doing a lot more.
Yeah, hopefully people realize that. And you know what? It's for profit. Our allies want our stuff. We should make our stuff. We should expand these missile defense companies, and then we'll see what happens. Also, they've got to get them HIMARS and ATACMS. I don't know how many we have, but I think we got to get them into the theater as quick as possible. I also think the $300 billion in frozen assets, we should just hand it over to Ukraine or threaten to do so. And if this continues, just give it to them and let them spend how they want it. Just on the overall price of missile of the Golden Dome, $750 billion, does that sound about right?
No. there's all kinds of numbers being tossed around. We're not going to be spending $750 billion on the Golden Dome. The amount put into the reconciliation bill, for instance, is $25 billion. You can do a lot for that in terms of increasing sensors and getting, more production. Would I like it to be more? Yes. But I think that you're probably going to be seeing things in that kind of order of magnitude, perhaps a little bit more in terms of the coming fiscal years. And so, in other words, notwithstanding all these sort of speculative numbers of what it might cost to build a perfect shield, I think that the good enough shield that we're going to do to contribute to deterrence by denial, deterrence by denial of attacks on the U.S. homeland, is going to be affordable, and it will have to be affordable. And I think that's probably the order of magnitude you're probably going to be seeing here in the next couple years.
How valuable and how ready are lasers to knock these drones out of the sky?
Yeah, well, I think directed energy broadly, jamming, lasers, high-powered microwaves. There's a good bunch of change in the reconciliation bill, a couple billion dollars for directed energy work. That's a good thing. We gave Israel $1.4 billion dollars just for its Iron Beam laser program. So they've actually come, the technology's come forward dramatically. Amazing. Over the past several of years. And it's got a little bit ways to go to be sure operational and reliable. Still has weather problems and that, so it's not a panacea. But there's some good progress being made there.
Does it disintegrate the drone?
Well, if again, if it can see it in line of sight, because it is limited by line of sight, it's going to burn it up in a small fraction of a second. There's other ways to fry it as well, as I said, high-powered microwaves and the like.
Right.
Reportedly, some of these things are actually getting battlefield use in Ukraine, and of course, we're also seeing operational employment in the Middle East.
I don't know how you feel, Tom, but I think that the talks with Iran are a colossal waste of time. I understand the merit in going through it, but they are just doing a delay of game. They're never going to dismantle. They're never going to stop spinning their centrifuges. They're never going to stop enriching. And if they said they did, I wouldn't believe it. We've had trials since 1979. This is not a new problem. Your thoughts about how this ends? Oh, we made marginal progress over the weekend. There'll be another meeting coming up.
Yeah, I think I'm similarly skeptical. I think we've got to go into this with our eyes wide open that they're probably going to be playing us. And anything short of a strongly verified results is probably not worth anything more than you can shake a stick at.
Right. And my thing is, too, in the region, it's the financing of the proxy groups. It's the ballistic missiles of all the proxy groups and the create havoc. So if we sit there and drill down on the enrichment capacity, we have not stopped the financing of these other groups. And as sanctions lift, those groups are going to get more money. It is not a good scenario. You can love peace all you want, but sometimes peace just postpones the trouble.
Yeah, I think that's right. Money is the sinews of war, and you've got to go after the money with Iran. That you got to hit him where it hurts. You got to hit Putin where it hurts, and that's his checking account. And Brian, you mentioned the $300 billion in frozen assets in Europe, for instance. You know, that's real money. And, you know, there's one thing to be taking the interest off of that frozen Russian assets. But as you said, going after the principal, at least beginning to take off, you know, chunks of the principal, that'll get Russia's attention, I think. And likewise with Iran, Israel has the capability. You've seen this in the news, to hit them, to take out their air defenses, things like that. The question is whether they could go after the nuclear program without the United States. That's probably a heavy lift, a tougher lift. But going after their money and having, I think, keeping the strikes on Iran as a bit more of a possibility, that's the only way to get Iran's attention. I think so far the United States, the White House, is pretty reluctant to do that. That's sort of been in the news, that Israel was more pro that than the administration. But I think you've got to keep it a possibility, just for negotiation. You know, as Herman Kahn once said, the best way to look willing is to be willing. And I don't think we are willing enough.
So this weekend on One Nation, I think we're going to go to NORAD, and they're going to explain the Golden Dome without giving away the technology. If you had one question after that press conference and with all your contacts that still needs to be answered, what should I make sure to ask on Sunday?
Ask them how fast we're going to get space sensors. And what we can do to get the space sensors that we need for tracking hypersonic and ballistic threats. We have the technology. We've got the prototypes. How fast are we going to contract that and get them up in orbit?
So space sensors that would track how far rockets are going on Earth, but not rockets going to take out satellites.
Well, you want to track those too.
Okay.
You want to track all of that.
That's a great question. Tom, thanks so much. I appreciate it. I know our audience does too. Tom Caracco, thank you.
All right. Thanks all.
All right. Listen, we're going to come back. I'm going to squeeze in some calls. I know you've been tracking the news. It has not slowed down just because the American people took 3 days off. So 1-866-408-7669. Quick announcement. I'm going to be in Dayton. Now it's not far away. It's close. Just around the corner. June 21st. WHIO listeners especially. Go to briankilmeade.com. We're going to be in theater. History, Liberty, and Laughs. It's a show like no other. If you want to hear about our history, you like patriotism, inspiration, motivation, it's your one-stop shopping. BrianKilmeade.com, along with Fox Nation.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A a radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Donald Trump brought millions of voters into the Republican Party by promising to cut taxes on tips, cut taxes on overtime, cut taxes on Social Security. He has to deliver for those voters, and he's going to deliver for those voters. Everything else is negotiable, right? I worked for 7 years in the Senate. I never saw the situation where the House sent over a bill and said, please don't change it, and the Senate said, sure.
Right. So he's being practical, and the Senate has it now. That's Mark Thiessen weighing in the Washington Post. So the House went out of their way to assuage moderates and Freedom Caucus, and by one vote, they hand this big, beautiful bill over to the Senate. The problem from Ron Johnson, Rand Paul, not enough cuts. The problem with Brian Fitzpatrick, moderate, too much manipulating with Medicaid, which I don't think enough has been done. You have to have bold moves, but will it work in these battleground districts? Will it cost you the House? That's worthy of discussion. The right thing for the country would be to look at our entitlements and say these are unaffordable and sustainable. That's the key, but not now, I don't think, with Trump waiting for the midterms a year away, knowing he gets nothing done if they lose the House, feeling decent about the Senate. Tom Tillis said, for example, there's a big pushback not to get rid of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is better known as the new green scam. You know, the green scam. Well, it's all it is energy, clean energy, made work projects in order to push forward that green agenda. Well, some of those projects, almost all of them are being built in red states, maybe intentionally, like North Carolina. And they're saying, really? You just had Ford open up a factory, electric car factory in South Carolina. To get it rid of to get away from the unions and build it affordable. Well, what happens to all those jobs? What happens to the wind projects? Okay, well, wind is not effective. It's not consistent. It does some damage. Well, if it's helping your city and it's got 5,000 jobs in your area and it could cost you a Senate seat, do you go for it? Rand Paul basically says, I'm not signing it. Ron Johnson says, I don't like it and we'll be able to change it. If they change it too much, it goes back to the House where the whole thing could implode. They have, Senate likely meets for, they have 51 days to July 4th. The Senate will meet for about half of those days. This is all they should be focusing on. But find a way to cut the spending. And I don't believe the CBO reports. They just did a study. Most of the people doing the CBO have been wrong, and mostly are Democrats. Hey, this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there. Keep it here on this beautiful Tuesday. Don't move.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. Not everyone is careful with your personal information, which might explain why there's a victim of identity theft every 5 seconds in the U.S. Fortunately, there's LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity. If your identity is stolen, a U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year by visiting LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. So glad you're here. And we're back after Memorial Day, full steam ahead. You're most likely back at work. If you're in college, you're probably saying to yourself, I'm done in May. Unless you're like my daughter with trimesters, that means you're done in June. Quick note, everybody listening to WOKV, it was great to be in Jacksonville outside Everbank Stadium. They got the biggest wall outside, the Vietnam Wall, where they commemorate all those who lost their lives from the area who served in the military over the 250 years of the country. So it's pretty impressive. It was great seeing everyone out there back and forth. And it's good to know, too, if you look at the stats, maybe because gas is so low, $3.03, which is basically back to 2019 levels, we had more travelers, 45 million people travel, which shows the economy, people feeling good about the economy and time to travel. It also means you're probably a little aggravated with all the traffic. So before we get to our next guest, Michael Goodwin, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. We're in the middle of talking, and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all. Something happened to this guy, and I don't like it.
Yeah, well, he's just getting worse, but he's always been bad, Mr. President. And hopefully you'll understand he has no interest in a ceasefire, even though it's in his interest to take the off-ramp that you took tremendous risk, political risk, in giving him. You can't make people make right decisions.
Number two.
Donald Trump brought millions of voters into the Republican Party by promising to cut taxes on tips, cut taxes on overtime, cut taxes on Social Security. He has to deliver for those voters, and he's going to deliver for those voters. What? Everything else is negotiable.
Right, and that's called the Senate. Now, we'll negotiate. It's your serve, Senate. The House delivers a big, beautiful bill, but some Republicans see big, ugly spending. The countdown to July 4th passage begins.
Number one.
Presidents get surrounded by people who have a vested interest in keeping that president propped up. So that's the only reason we invoke Watergate, is just to make clear, like, it's not Watergate. Right. This is an entirely separate scandal, maybe even worse.
It's not letting up. The steady stream of facts about Joe Biden's invisibility and disability are flooding forward. And the scandal further hamstrings the Democratic Party as a familiar name emerges as a contender to drag them from left to center. Good luck with that. And that, of course, is the top story, as Joe Biden's inability to run the country, well chronicled in columns like Michael Goodwin's on various times over the last 4 years, even when he was running in 2019. And now I'm just stunned at this news cycle, because we started with the Russia hoax, we had the pandemic, and then we have the laptop, and now we got this. Major lies perpetrated by one group of people, one party, and they want to make money off it. Michael Goodwin, welcome back.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you.
Your thoughts about the revelations that we all knew about, but more details have emerged with Joe Biden.
You know, Brian, as you were saying this, it occurs to me that the reason why it's getting attention now has very much to do with politics. And Jake Tapper is CNN, which is left-wing. And so I think without Jake Tapper's name on this book, which, as I understand, he didn't do most of the reporting, his partner did, his co-author, I think we would not have this sense that, oh, my God, something was really wrong. Because
so if you wrote the book, Michael, you're saying if you wrote the book, if you wrote the book and you had the sources, most unnamed, you're saying that Michael Goodwin, even though your substance would be great, you would not get the attention or the sales.
Absolutely. And neither would you.
Nope.
I mean, that is how the country has divided itself, that there are conservative-leaning journalists like you and me, and then there are the far left, you know, like Jake Tapper. But so when Jake Tapper blows the whistle on the Democrats, oh, my God, it's a scandal. If you and I did this book, It would be a better book, but it would be right-wing talking points, right? That's how the left characterized everything that was said about Joe Biden's cognitive decline, right-wing talking points, deep fake videos, they said. Now all of it's come back because of Tapper, but it's really come back because it was true. Right? Because it was unavoidable, and people are saying, oh, yeah, I did see some of that, right? Oh, yeah, you're right about that. So it's a bizarre function of our polarization, but the left will not accept anything said by conservatives until it's said by the left itself. And Jake Tapper, I think, has, in effect, you know, scored his own goal, right, or his team's own goal here by simply reporting what was obvious to many of us and what we said for years, but which Jake Tapper scoffed at.
Here's just let's go back in time where Mayorkas, KJP, and Ron Klain were asked these questions. Cut one.
I think you all have called this the cheap fakes video, and that's exactly what they are. They are cheap fakes video. The right-wing critics of the president have a credibility problem.
The most difficult part about a meeting with President Biden is preparing for it, because he is sharp, intensely probing, and detail-oriented and focused.
The president is absolutely sharp, fit, on top of his game. People can see that for themselves. You don't have to take my word for it. People can see that for themselves.
Are you kidding? We would hear stuff like that, and our mind would just spin out. Okay, these people they think we're idiots. We see for ourselves. Biden goes, watch me. Yeah, we watch you. You're pathetic. We don't know how you get a word out. This is what I concluded. I could play you some clips from the interviews. And I don't know how you feel about this. I was stunned when they made the announcement in May that Joe Biden himself, in a harshly, awkwardly put tape, when now we know it took forever to edit it, challenged Trump to two debates, June and September. And he said, I hear you have off on Wednesdays. And I thought, what? Who is doing this? Donald Trump is on trial in New York. It's a sham, but he gets convicted. He loses his civil suit. It's a sham, but it gets convicted. They're trying to destroy his business. He gets fined $450 million. He had to scramble to get a bond. And all of a sudden, Joe Biden goes, do you want a debate? And I'm thinking to myself, why would he do this? Like, who is doing this? And what it did is, on some level, somebody wanted to expose him as somebody with half a brain who's unable to function. And they wanted this to happen. They allowed him to travel back and forth to Europe two or three times before a major event. They go ahead and they watch him crash during the training, during the study hours, and they didn't try to postpone it with the cold or whatever. They didn't need to debate Michael Goodwin. They did not need to. They would have said Donald Trump is not worthy. He's a criminal. And we wouldn't have bought it, but the rest of the country would have. Who did that June debate?
Well, I would take the same set of facts, and I would give them a somewhat different characterization, Brian, which is not that it was an attempt to scuttle Biden, but it was the donors who were nervous. And they didn't – you're right about the scheduling. I mean, it was crazy. Two trips to Europe in the same month that he's going to debate. Hunter Biden's trial was scheduled to begin, remember that, in California. But I think the other thing that proves that this was an attempt to establish Biden as a bona fide candidate rather than destroy him is that the donors and the campaign spent $50 million on television ads in June. You don't spend that kind of TV money in June for a November election. So I think they were trying to rescue Biden. I think there was a lot of fear that he wasn't up to it. But this whole thing of spending money on the ads and doing the debate was going to prove that he was capable not only of winning but of governing for four more years.
But they knew he
wasn't. So they were sadly mistaken, but I don't think they were trying to upend him.
But these revelations show that he was barely a member of the board that's running the country, and it was a bunch of hand-picked aides, not cabinet secretaries, that was Senate confirmed. So these people that were with him saw him failing, sleeping, nodding off, no cards to be able to walk, to find an open chair. They must have known, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to expose everything that we hid during to get him elected, and we're going to expose it so we could go pick somebody else.
Well, but Brian, I would add this too. Don't forget, he could have dropped out in 23, but he insisted on running again, right? And so the primaries are shut down. Dean Phillips is, you know, put in a corner. I think we shouldn't forget that a lot of this has to do with the hatred of Donald Trump, this idea that Donald Trump cannot win. And therefore, anything you do to defeat Donald Trump is acceptable among the left. If you have to prop up a corpse, no problem. We'll put makeup on it. We'll spend money on ads that will show him being vigorous. We'll lie about everything. We'll send Mayorkas out to say, what a tough interviewer he is. Boy, is he tough. You know, what does Karine Jean-Pierre say? Oh, we all have trouble keeping up with him. He's sharp as a tack, right? Yeah, Kamala Harris said that. So it was all about the lie in order to defeat Donald Trump. We'll deal with the second term when we get to it. You know, if he has to resign and Kamala becomes president, that'll be great. We'll make history. He'll be a transition figure. But we'll do anything to stop Donald Trump. Right. I think that's the category into which all of this must be seen.
And there was some movement about get rid of Kamala Harris. Remember, Jamie Raskin and others would not say that you'd be a good move. So maybe behind the scenes, they're like, we got to get her off the ticket. And somebody, if they had a 45-year-old vigorous guy or woman that was impressive, he would have been kicked off in the first term, showing how they would turn on him in a second. Listen to what Jake Tapper was asked by Piers Morgan, and tell me if you think he's right. Cut 10.
maybe even worse than Watergate in some ways.
Right.
Because Richard Nixon was in control of his faculties when he wasn't drinking. And, you know, so the idea that the only reason that we have the Watergate thing is there because we quote Archibald Cox, who was a Watergate investigator, talking about how powerful the presidency is and how presidents get surrounded by people who have a vested interest in keeping that president propped up. So that's the only reason we invoke Watergate, is just to make clear, like, it's not Watergate. Right. This is an entirely separate scandal. Maybe even worse. Maybe even worse.
Your thoughts?
Look, I think that's a valid point of view, that propping up a president is a lot of people have interest in that. Right. I mean, some of those interests are purely personal. Some are venal. Others are just about in terms of the country, the party. All kinds of motivations go into propping up a president who's no longer fit to hold the job, because it's an extremely partisan effort. The whole thing is partisan. It's not about the country. That's the highfalutin language that we all dream about. That's, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington and all of the ideals that we hold our government in. But inside the hothouse at the 11th hour, it's kind of an every party for itself, every man and woman for themselves, because we gotta keep this ship from sinking. And I think that's all it comes down to. It's just personal. It's all very personal at the end of the day, because it is all about survival. And that Joe Biden wasn't fit seems to have drifted out of the argument. It's no longer part of the conversation. We know he's not fit. We just got to keep pretending that he is for six more months.
But do you realize that nothing's changed, because they lied to us that he has this devastating cancer and they just found out? Nobody believes that.
No.
And the story, they haven't had a PSA test since 2014. Nobody believes that. And nobody believes that their doctor is legitimate. He's either the worst doctor or the most compliant doctor in the history of the country.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Brian, I think there's another element to consider, too, which is Hunter Biden. I think the father, understandably, was very concerned the son was going to go to prison, might even rat out the whole family, the whole scam of influence peddling. But also, I think he deeply loves his son and wanted to protect him. And by staying in office, he could protect him. He was able to pardon him. If he had been elected to a second term, the family could be back in business. I mean, I think that the question of who's going to feed Hunter and his children for the next 30 years must weigh on the president. Nonetheless, all of these become excuses for the inexcusable, which is that he was not fit to even be president in 2023 and 2024, let alone, you know, 2028. 2029. I mean, he was simply not up to the job anymore, as the country could see it. And Jake Tapper was among those, you know, playing the Praetorian Guard to protect Joe Biden from the truth.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And now he's going to make money off it. Now he's doing interviews, and it just kills me. And he got 200 interviews. He said 200 sources in 2 weeks. So he's saying, well, they weren't talking to me before. I'm sure some of them were talking to you before, right? You wouldn't have gotten 200, but you would have gotten enough. And that would have been a huge story, but nobody at your company wanted you to do it. And most importantly, you didn't want to do it. So I'm not buying the book, because I've lived it. No one was listening. Not enough people were listening, even though he came out and said conservative media had it right. Well, you also have to add in, they were right about Russia, and conservative media was right about the laptop. All those were lying. So it's a fascinating time, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
All right, Michael Goodwin, New York Post, 1-866-408-7669. Bottom of the hour, Nicholas Eberstadt will join us. He holds he's going to talk about the economy. He's from AEI. He's going to talk about the big, beautiful bill and what we could do to Russia if we wanted. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. 1-866-408-7669. This bottom of the hour, we're going to talk about the economy. But right now, I want to talk to Sandra. Hey, Sandra, you're on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, hi, Brian. Welcome back. You were missed.
Thank you.
I wanted to say something on my mind. Do you remember the speech that the president of Colombia gave about Camille?
Mahmoud Khalil.
Right. Exactly. And then a new speech given by a CBS anchor, Scott Pelley, I believe his name is.
Awful. Giving I'm going to play some of that.
Okay, giving us the hate speech about Trump. Now, here's my point, Brian. I understand we have freedom of speech. I get that. But I'm thinking that first speech incited such a riot. Maybe those two lovely people were shot, and this instigated it, and then having hate for Trump. This is bad. So I would like to know, maybe these speeches should be checked by both sides of the spectrum before they speak them, they say them.
Well, actually, at NYU, they had a speaker, I guess a valedictorian or president of class. She went off her copy, and the whole faculty cheered her, but they ended up not giving her a degree because it was so anti-Semitic and anti-American. And they do check the speeches now, and they had safeguards in place in a lot of them. But when the president, the interim president of the college, starts citing about Khalil and saluting him, you really can't do anything about it because she's leaving. She's a former anchor, network anchor. She's leaving the position, and she's basically has nothing to lose. But I would not send my kid there. And I'm telling you, the Ivy League deserves everything they're getting right now, all of it.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
But I do think the deficit is a threat to our country. I think it's the greatest threat to our national security. And so I think you can't do this. We bring in about $5 trillion in revenue, and we spend $7 trillion. That's about what we do. The $5 trillion is consumed by Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, and other welfare programs. The mandatory programs consume all of it. So the people say, well, we're taking this off the table, and we're not going to touch any of those programs. Well, they're just not, frankly, serious.
So that is Rand Paul. He's not without merit his argument. I get it. But he's somebody who doesn't get involved. So what I would do if I was Rand Paul from Kentucky, I go, listen, these are my objectives. I want to get involved here. I'm going to debate with my Democratic and Republican colleagues, conservatives and moderates, and I'm going to try to get some of that in, some more cuts in. I don't sit on the side and just say, no, I'm not going to vote. Same thing with Tom Massey. So that's how I would approach it. But I'm not saying what he says is not doesn't have merit, because I just talked to Ray Dalio, and you probably heard the interview. I hope you liked it. He's one of the best investors in the country. He's also a study of why dynasties fail. And he says the biggest problem we have is the debt. That's what worries him most. It's 7% of the GDP. He got to get it down to 3. Nicholas Aberstadt joins us now. He holds the Henry Wendt Chair at the Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute over at AEI. Nicholas, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Big Beautiful Bill is on the Senate's is in the Senate's hands right now. What do you like and what don't you like about it? And what do you hope the Senate changes about it?
Well, the arithmetic doesn't work for the long term for the USA. As you were mentioning, we've got this enormous gap between revenues we're taking in and the outlays that we're spending. That's not new. It may get a little bit worse on its current specifications. The problem, Brian, is basically we've stumbled into this really bad habit of financing current consumption through our entitlement programs on the basis of debt, which means that the kids and unborn Americans are financing the retirement of seniors today. And that's just not sustainable.
Understood. President said he didn't want to touch entitlements. That's the problem. Medicaid, there's going to be a work requirement. They have different ways of enforcing it. But when Obamacare comes out and says, I'm expanding Medicaid to cover more people, and I want the federal government, if you choose, states, to pay the bulk of that, and I only think about 10 to 12 have not taken the money yet, now all of a sudden the federal deficit gets even higher, and Medicaid, a state program, gets even bigger. and we didn't, we're not fully attacking it because politically it's detrimental in these battleground states. Am I correct?
I don't think I could have put it better than that, Brian. We don't really have a constituency in U.S. politics today for budget discipline. We've got some, you know, honorable exceptions to the rule, but we've been going basically in the wrong direction for a generation.
I want you to hear what Ron Johnson said, because he is not on board. He has a business background. Cut 27.
I think we have enough to stop the process until the president gets serious about spending reduction and reducing the deficit. You don't defeat the deep state by funding it.
And he's frustrated. And I know you know how legislation works. If he changes too much, it goes back to the House, and then it's so tenuous. The Freedom Caucus is going to fight with the Moderate Caucus and the SALT Caucus. So here we go again.
No, absolutely. I mean, everything seems to be kind of okay until it isn't. I mean, Paul Ryan, a decade and a half ago, was talking about the bond market vigilantes who were going to make everybody wake up in a really bad sort of way to this budget profligacy. They didn't come on Paul Ryan's tour of duty. It doesn't mean they're not going to come.
So you like the innovation in our economy. Most people do. They also look at the unemployment number. That looks pretty strong. If you look at what we're actually, in terms of revenue, the revenue's fine. It's the spending. In fact, Ron Johnson pointed out that we were at, before the pandemic, we were spending $4.5 trillion, and now we're up around $7. And no one really feels like we're flooded with cash anymore. You know, so there was a time when we were just sending cash out to people during the pandemic. So what happened during that period that we spent $2 trillion extra?
Well, we had a sort of a, what would you call it, a COVID pinata that we broke open and used to, you know, send money to so many Americans. There was this huge fund that Americans had trillions of dollars in, kind of like nest egg temporarily. And that's one of the reasons that we got such a nice inflation kick during that period, as you'll recall. It didn't have that much effect on the jobs market. We had an enormous peacetime labor shortage for a while in 2022. That was also partly a consequence of that. But that money has been spent. We're kind of living on wealth effects, from homes and from equities at this point, and that's great as long as it lasts, and I hope this is going to last a whole long time. But in economics, there's also something that people talk about, which is called a Minsky moment, which is when you go from being, like, really prosperous on the basis of partly of debt until you have to get it, you know, until you have to pay the debt and you get into kind of a squeeze and things kind of pop. I just hope that we're not setting ourselves up for a Minsky moment with the way we're going right now.
So how do you feel about the CBO? When they come out with their numbers, what does Nicholas Eberstadt think about that?
Well, it depends which numbers you're talking about. I
mean, well, they project they were going to add $2 trillion to the debt, and they would
That looks like a pretty good baseline. Okay. That we can debate around the fine points of it. Is it a little high? Is it a little low? But that's, I mean, they're pretty solid citizens on that stuff.
When you look at the trade, what the president's trying to do, the restructured trade, we got one deal in, the EU promises to pick up the pace, so that was a scare Friday, the markets hated. And now we have China's on delay, but we're taking a look at, they're worried about their jobs in manufacturing, and we're worried about their, and they're also holding back some rare earth that we need and some things for our weapons and for our computer chips. What do you hope comes out of this multi-nation trade negotiation?
Well, I was trained in economics back in the Stone Age, and so I don't believe in the lump of wealth fallacy. I don't believe that the good Lord dropped a certain amount of money in the world, and that we figure out how much of it we get through trade negotiations. We can create wealth and we can destroy wealth. And tariffs are a wonderful way of destroying wealth for everybody. It's a tax on American citizens. It's a direct contributor to U.S. inflation. There are good reasons for treating China differently from any of our other trading partners. I mean, China's economy is run by the CCP, and you have to be really careful about what you do with a CCP-dominated economy. But in general, we don't want to destroy the extraordinary wealth-making machine that the United States has helped to build internationally over the last three generations. And tariffs and unpredictable tariff negotiations are a great way of inadvertently doing that.
But in a way, don't you believe that, yes, China does supply a lot of the material for our country, and they basically used a lot of the revenue of us, our purchases, to build up their military and build up their economy. And now I'm hearing stories that there are people who aren't working. The younger people aren't working. There's other people that can't get jobs. Some people aren't getting paid. And there's a sense that manufacturing has really slowed down in that country. They built these cities that are not occupied by people. They were make work projects. So, I mean, we don't know in that society what the truth is. But the stuff that's leaking out sounds pretty detrimental.
No argument on that, Brian. That's why I said that I think China has to be treated as a special case, and we have to look at it strategically, differently from the way we can look at trade with the rest of the world economy. The CCP is not our friend, and the CCP dominates China's economy. It's involved in so much of the economic transactions that we have. It creates constituency groups in the United States. Look at the way the NBA grovels in front of the Chinese government when one of the players says something moderately favorable about Taiwan.
It's embarrassing.
We don't want to create domestic constituencies that support the CCP.
So what they've done, so as they started feeling what you're just saying, that America realizes we cannot depend on them, especially after the pandemic, when it comes to PPE and rare earth and all these other things. So they're beginning to manufacture their own chips and do a lot of their own manufacturing because they don't want to depend on us at all. We have the same feeling. So I know that people from the Pentagon goes, well, if we're not trading, it makes war more likely. But if you were in charge of our economy, how would you responsibly decouple, or would you?
You know, Brian, I wrote a little book about this with my colleague Dan Blumenthal 5 years ago, and we argued that America doesn't even have the language yet for thinking through which areas of trade benefit us on net, which areas benefit the CCP on net, which are kind of neutral. We've got to think much more strategically about our transactions with China. We have been moving in the direction of we call it de-risking. There's a lot more that we can do in that respect.
Well, I guess we're all going to see what's going to happen in July, in the summer, and where we go. When we talk about bringing manufacturing here, President Trump said over the weekend, I don't want to make socks, I want to make chips. What do you think he means by that?
I think he wants to resource, bring home a lot of the chip manufacturing that we see internationally, and that's a great objective. It's much easier said than done, of course, because Taiwan at this point has got such a comparative advantage in its built infrastructure, in its factories, in the training that the Taiwan workforce has there. If it's going to be a U.S. project, it's going to be a long-term one. We can't do it with a magic wand overnight.
I just do think we can go out and lock up some rare earth and build some refineries rapidly. Don't you agree?
Yeah, we can get that stuff started, but we also need the technical skills and the workforce and the managerial and stuff. I mean, there's a reason that Intel is struggling and Taiwan Semiconductor is flourishing.
Right, because we're trying to bring things back. And that's why when Tim Cook was told by President Trump, bring your manufacturing back here, you said you're going to put $500 billion, and where we're not seeing it, his effective argument? Is he being candid when he says, we don't have the workers? I can't bring it back here?
Well, it is difficult to create the skills by fiat. You have to have the incentives for it. It's got to be a long-term project. There's got to be predictability and certainty to it. You know the businesses hate uncertainty, and they hate the idea that one administration is going to be in favor of one flavor, and then the next one is going to turn to another flavor. That it's very hard to invest over the long term if there's not predictability.
Understood. It's going to be an interesting time. Nicholas Eberstadt, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right. Same here. 1-866-408-7669. I don't want to say it's all negative about the big, beautiful bill. There's a lot of positives to it, but I wanted to have the economists talk about the things that are going to be debated in the Senate. We got to get the expertise and not cheerleading. Cheerleading doesn't help anybody. I just want to get the facts, especially when it comes to the economy. Back in a moment with the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
In some ways, I'm glad I missed that second term where it was, because I wouldn't be your president. For that most important of all, in addition, we have the World Cup and we have the Olympics. Can you imagine? I missed that 4 years, and now look what I have. I have everything. Amazing the way things work out. God did that. I believe that, too. You know, I got the World Cup and I got the Olympics. The 250 years was not mine. I'd like to take credit. But I got the Olympics. I got the World Cup when I was president.
So the president of the United States knows it's going to be a really special term, just on events alone, let alone what he decides to do with the economy, getting out of wars, building up our military, and all the agenda that he wants passed with this bill. But it just does bring, it is interesting to go four in, four out, four back. And you do have the World Cup next year, will be huge. You have the 250th birthday. I already know they're already doing some major things about it. I'll be announcing a book about it that I think is going to play an important role and be an interesting conversation point on this show. And then we're going to see the World Cup and the Olympics. The Olympics is going to be fantastic. I think it's going to be well done. I'm sure security will be an issue. I also think there's going to be boycotts are going to be an issue. I'm sure China's thinking twice about it. I don't know if, Russia can ever be trusted with they were caught cheating again. But for the most part, Los Angeles, the last time we had the Olympics, we had a partial Olympics because most of the communist world sat out. Remember, I don't see Russia or China getting an Olympics again. But in the past, that's how where the world was. Think about this. Russia and China. Okay, Beijing got it and Russia got it. And Russia waited till after the Olympics and then they invaded Georgia. That was pretty nice, wasn't it? I remember George W. Bush was president back then. But the president of the United States is extremely hardworking, is extremely focused. I have never seen him with more energy or sharper. But I'm reading all these stories in Drudge, which just is an abomination these days. They're just so anti-Trump, even more than anti-Republican. They're anti-Trump. They're writing stories how they don't like the way a speech does. They have a line here. They question his intellect. I mean, of all people, Congresswoman Crockett in Texas is questioning the president's intellect. He's losing it. I don't like his speech at West Point. Really? This woman talks like she's from some street gang on a regular basis, mocking people in wheelchairs. We just watched a president's cognitive ability be totally plowed over, ignored, and protected for 4 years, now exposed by everyone on the left and right. And they want to go, Donald Trump is losing it. You have no credibility. I'm going to add something else. Rahm Emanuel made some news over the weekend. An interview with the Wall Street Journal came out and said, essentially, the Democratic Party brand is toxic. We have to stop being to the left. We have to stop with pronouns. And we got to start being more of a centrist party. And he thinks he's the one to do it. Now, let me ask you something. Was Rahm Emanuel stuck in Japan, never talked to the president? Is that what he's going to say? That might be something he can get away with. But anybody that wants to be president and wants to run and has anything to do with that White House, Joe Biden's, like Pete Buttigieg, is done. If Blinken or any of these guys want to run, they're done. I think also, you know, anybody who wants to work in a White House again will never get confirmed after what they look past with President Biden. Other people are just going to say, I never talked to him, which should have raised red flags. Like, for example, you're going to tell me Rahm Emanuel, with all his contacts, didn't know Joe Biden was shot for 4 years?
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
All right, that's right. I am very approachable. Hi, everybody. I'm so excited to be here right after Memorial Day. Now it's the sprint of the summer. College is done, unless you're in a trimester. And now people in grammar school in New York and the Northeast anyway probably got to the middle of June, but you start thinking about the following year and what you're doing this summer. Internships on the way. Courage to see Memorial Day. So many people traveling. The cost of gas has a lot to do with it. And that has a lot to do with the energy, this pro-energy administration. No question about it. A lot of moving parts today, a lot of repeats over the weekend, so let's get started.
Number three.
I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. We're in the middle of talking, and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all. Something happened to this guy, and I don't like it.
All right, Putin, you're about to have your only off-ramp closed. Trump explodes while Russia bombs. While the president could do what the president could do now to make Putin pay a steeper price for the war he started and continues.
Number two.
Donald Trump brought millions of voters into the Republican Party by promising to cut taxes on tips, cut taxes on overtime, cut taxes on Social Security. He has to deliver for those voters, and he's going to deliver for those voters. Everything else is negotiable.
Well, let's tell that to the Senate. It is your serve. The House delivers a big, beautiful bill, but some Republicans see a big, ugly spending package. The countdown to July 4th passage begins.
Number one.
Presidents get surrounded by people who have a vested interest in keeping that president propped up. So that's the only reason we invoke Watergate, is just to make clear, like, it's not Watergate. Right. This is an entirely separate scandal, maybe even worse.
It's not letting up. The steady stream of facts about Joe Biden's invisibility and disability are flooding forward, and the scandal further hamstrings the Dem Party as a familiar name emerges as a contender to drag them from left to the center. Good luck with that. And I'm talking about Rahm Emanuel. That's the name in the Wall Street Journal story that is kind of a big deal. Was a big deal over the weekend. It's impossible to ignore, even though this war seems to have lasted forever, that Russia started unprovoked, is Russia. I mean, the numbers are stunning. How much they have actually bombed and how much action they have actually taken. Look at these numbers as we bring in Daniel Hoffman in about what they've done. Over the past week, they've directed 1,390 drones, 94 missiles targeted across Ukraine. The attacks killed 30 civilians and injured more than 163. These are over civilian sites. They're trying to bombard Kyiv and make some progress on the ground. In addition to ballistic missiles, they fired another 900 drones and 65 cruise missiles. I'm encouraged by this. Germany's new chancellor, Friedrich Merz, says the U.S., Germany, France, and U.K. will no longer impose range restrictions on Ukraine's use of weapons supplied by Western allies like ATACMS and HIMARS. Joining us now is former CIA station chief over in Moscow, Daniel Hoffman. Daniel, why is Putin refusing to even pretend to take an off-ramp that Trump's taking tremendous political risk, a lot of political risk to give him?
Well, I think, look, from the beginning, I said that we've got to be careful about assuming that Putin wants an off-ramp. He was the one who launched this brutal invasion over 3 years ago. He has swiveled Russia to an axis of dictatorships. His closest allies are now China and North Korea and Iran. Ukraine, for Putin, was always an existential threat, not because Ukraine was going to invade Russia or anything of the sort. It's that Ukraine has this sizable Russian-speaking population, and Ukraine was developing close commercial and strategic ties with Europe, and Putin could never allow that. If you've ever been to Estonia, where I used to live for years, the thing that really bothers Vladimir Putin is when he looks out over at Estonia and how successful the Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, those Baltic states are, it's in direct contrast to over the border in Russia. It's like the Wizard of Oz movie, where you go from black and white to color, where one side is vibrant economically with great medical care and education systems, and on the other side, they're living in like the 19th century. So that's what Putin wanted. I'll just say one last thing, Brian. When I was serving in Russia. It was an old Russian intelligence officer who told me that the West just didn't understand Putin. If Putin lives in a not so great house, not literally because he's got a great, you know, palatial estate, but Russia's not so nice, and his neighbor lives in a nicer place, he's just going to go burn down his neighbor's home, and so they can both live in squalor. That's sort of the way that Putin looks at things.
All right, something to keep in mind. So it doesn't bother him. Now his economy shifted to the point where it would really hurt them to stop making weapons, right, and not be at war.
Well, they've got an unbalanced wartime economy. They'd be better off economically if they stopped the war, stopped the brain drain of Russians fleeing Russia, the ones who can, and if they swiveled their economy to the West again. But Putin doesn't want to do that.
We've
offered
it. He'd
be better off if he did it, but he doesn't want to do it because what's most important to him is his own regime security, and what scares him the most is democracy. I was talking about that on Fox yesterday on TV. That's what scares Putin. He could never be – he doesn't see the world the way we do, and even though President Trump is concerned about thousands of soldiers and civilians being killed, Putin doesn't care. He's never cared. It doesn't matter to him.
I guess so. Here's what General Keane says we could do. Cut 18.
What should be done? The president almost answered. Crippling sanctions, to be sure, but also, listen, this is important because Putin pays attention to this actually more than he does with sanctions. He always thinks he can get around sanctions, and he has some evidence to prove it, and that is continued military assistance to Ukraine. That makes a difference on the battlefield. After all, we're 39 months into the war, and Putin isn't even close to taking control of Ukraine. He's still trying to get control of the four provinces, or oblasts, as Ukrainians call them, that he believes are theirs. And Ukraine still owns two of the oblast capital cities. So Putin is nowhere near where he wants to be, and we can stop him from getting there, certainly.
So look, the Ukraine says they have money. They want to be able to buy stuff. They have a motivated European Union to help him. We don't have the patriots to spare to give him. But the other Western nations do. What's possible in this environment, Dan?
Well, first of all, we need to rebuild our defense industrial base.
I know.
It's important for us to be the arsenal of democracy and support our allies who are trying to deter aggression. That would be Taiwan and among others. Israel is in a fight. Look, if we don't do what we've always done, which is to support our fellow democracies, then we're going to be in a bad place. But General Keane is right. We need to increase military support to Ukraine and make it clear to Putin that this war of his is a loser. Putin has failed. He is not winning the war. His strategic objective was to overthrow the government of Kyiv and establish a new puppet regime there that would be beholden to him. And he's failed to do that. And he's suffered a lot of consequences that his own people know about, specifically his military and intelligence services. And that's one reason why Putin continues this war. I'm sorry to say it's likely to go on as long as Putin is alive or still in power. You almost need to convince the guys around him that the war is just not winnable and they need to swivel in a different direction.
Dan, do you really believe that that is it, that someone has to take him out for this to stop? How about the $300 billion that is frozen? What if we just give it to Ukraine? You know, what if third-party sanctions on India and China? You know, what if the gas price of per barrel of oil stays around $60? I mean, that could really make life uncomfortable, along with central bank sanctions.
It could. It's the penultimate question I'd be asking Director of CIA Ratcliffe. Give me some evidence to show that this is not just this is Putin's war, and he's not going to let go of it until he's gone. Give me evidence to the contrary, please, because he doesn't care how much his country suffers as a result of his war. And I'm just not so sure I see him stopping. What we can do is we can stop the onslaught and make it clear to the Russian military that carrying on the war just isn't anything but resulting in more cannon fodder. And what that does is builds up the pressure inside Russia to make Putin stop. We're not going to make him stop, but his own military might, his own intelligence services might, but we're not going to do it. The way we do it is by making it clear to all those Russian soldiers that every step they take forward is going to result in a bullet to their head. That's it, Brian. I'm sorry to say it, but that's what Putin's doing to us.
And I hear you, but a couple of things
I say it based on the years I spent there and trying to see the world through the twisted KGB eyes of Vladimir Putin. He's not like us. And if you mirror image, you end up in a bad place.
But, you know, you do have an off-ramp with saving face, with an economic incentives from Trump, who doesn't care what people think. He's going to go, yep, I told them we're going to do a rare earth deal with them. I told them we're going to get him, you know, supplement his the issues he's got with agriculture. And he could automatically, all of a sudden, have a dialogue with the superpower of the world, along with China. I could see that if he was a clear-thinking guy, the advantage at 72 years old of doing that. But a couple of things happened that are not predicted. Because Russia's distracted with Ukraine, they took their eye off the ball and they lost Syria. And guess who else lost Syria? Iran. And right. Guess what could happen, too? If Iran, I think, continues to drag us out in talks and embarrass this president, and if Israel feels they're threatened, and they are, and they are weeks away, they could lose Iran. And then they lose their drone factory. Am I correct?
That's certainly possible. Iran is weaker today than they've ever been, thanks to the fact that Israel has decimated Iran's proxy terrorists as well as Iran's air defenses. So, yes, you're right. And Russia doesn't have the wherewithal to support anybody else militarily.
Yes.
They're so focused on Ukraine. So that enters into this discussion as well.
When I look at what's going on with Iran right now, I saw they had a desperate move before President went to Saudi Arabia to try to get a consortium to enrich uranium outside three countries, UAE.
Right.
All right. That seems to me pretty desperate. Number two is Israel has already shown they got incredible intelligence about where this stuff is located, where the nuclear material is located, where the factories are. If these talks continue to produce nothing of substance, Trump's not going to have a choice. He doesn't want to start a Middle East war, but he's not a dumb guy. He's got to know that he's being played. And if he walks away with a deal that looks like Obama's, that's for him is his kryptonite. Anyone who compares this deal to the one that he got elected and ripping up, I think that both things are heading our direction. Trump is... gave every option to Iran, is giving every option to Putin, and they are walking away from two deals of a lifetime. And it should not surprise you, Dan, but it surprises me.
Yeah, well, they're acting rationally, Russia, Putin, and the Ayatollah. They're acting rationally for them. But look, Brian, I don't disagree with you at all. The president gave Iran 2 months. We're kind of at that point right now. And so a decision is going to have to be made about what we do about Iran's nuclear program. They're a nuclear threshold state. They are super close to weaponizing a nuclear weapon, a bomb, and that would be catastrophic for the region and beyond because of Iran's ballistic missile program. So this is another one. Look, that one, Gaza, the war in Ukraine, deterring China from launching on Taiwan. Let's not forget that we've got a terrorist problem thanks to the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which has left us more vulnerable than ever, where ISIS and Al-Qaeda have the kind of open field running in South Asia that they haven't had since before 9/11. So there's a lot of terrorist threats out there and plenty of work for our intelligence community and the National Security Council staff to work on.
They do. But sooner or later, these moving parts, the spinning plates have to come down. And they might be all coming down at the same time. And I always trust Israel's instincts better than ours because they understand the region better. Not Russia, but when it comes to Hamas and Iran. And I think they are running out of patience. And they've already shown in the past they will act alone, even before Netanyahu is in power. So I think something's going to happen. Do you think something's going to happen soon?
Well, reportedly, Israel was poised to launch a strike, and they held off. So, I mean, look, that's the weapon is, like, locked and loaded at Iran. And if Iran doesn't come to a deal with the United States, then this is what they're going to have to deal with. And that would be catastrophic for the region, and we want to avoid that. But at some point, you don't get a deal if you don't legitimately threaten the consequences of not making a deal. And that's what the president needs to do.
I know. It's about time. It's got to come soon. Dan, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right, Brian. Have a great rest of your week.
You got it. Thanks for the insight. 1-866-408-7669. Brian Kilmeade Show. Back with your calls in just a moment. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadeShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
The stain of having one way or another participated in this old system where they were pretending that Biden was fine. Those members of Congress had more reason than the ordinary American citizen had to notice Biden's condition. It was screamingly obvious to anybody willing to face it. I think they all knew, members of Congress, members of the administration, prominent Democrats across the country. They all saw this. Some of them pretended, most of them pretended it wasn't happening. And I think they're stained by that. The question, I think, for all of them is whether that stain will wear off in time for the presidential election coming up in 2028. I'm not sure it will. This was a pretty big deal.
It is a big deal, and it is still the top story, and it's not going away. And Britt Hume should be as angry as anyone. Why? Because Britt Hume's about the age of Joe Biden, and you see how sharp he is. If you talk to him, he always says, oh, I'm not as sharp as I was. He's great. And what he says, the guy's got dementia. Everyone says, oh, my goodness, you can't believe this. What's with Britt Hume? We weren't saying that. Fox wasn't saying that. The rest of the country was. Mediaite, these media websites, all can't believe it. You know what? And now, few people are outraged. Now, nobody's outraged. And Britt Hume is outraged because people are now pretending as if they're just discovering it. And they want to vilify his cadre of Politburo members that surrounded him when... And Jake Tapper says, I couldn't penetrate the immovable force, which is a Democratic Party, which is, and I'm at CNN, but I had no inroads there. But when the election's over, I had 200 sources. So it is just so maddening. But for Britt Hume, with all his experience, who actually went on the limb to say, guy's got dementia, guy's got problems, guy's got Parkinson's, and people just ripped him. And there's the most important thing, as you should understand, is they're still lying to us. I feel bad that he's got terrible cancer. I don't believe that he hasn't had a PSA test since 2014. I don't believe that he just discovered he had it after his appointment on The View. They're still lying to you. And now he's out, they say, trying to drum up money for speeches that nobody wants. He charges $300,000 a speech. Who the hell would, I wouldn't pay $30 for a speech of his. You can't understand it. And then he wants a library, the Biden library. For Biden, if they put up a bunch of things that they say he's done, it would be the first time he's seen him. There's going to be an investigation into what he signed. I mean, do you really think he signed and understood over 1,000 pardons that he gave? Do you think that he understood what he was signing? And, you know, I'm going to have Speaker Johnson on, and I'm going to ask him, to reiterate that story for you, where he said he walked into the office and said, why the hell would you freeze all fracking? Why would you freeze natural gas sales? He goes, I didn't. He goes, I'm exploring. He goes, no, Mr. President, you stopped it. It's like, I stopped it. I didn't stop it. Yeah, you did. Or someone who worked for you did, and not even a cabinet secretary. I mean, how irresponsible to not run a country after you get elected and to lie about it.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
What would you like President Trump to do about the situation that we've just seen on the screen?
I don't know. Look, these are articles over the last few days. Death of people. Death. 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 Horrible death. Death. I don't know. To pick anyone, white South Africans are fleeing because of the violence and racist laws. And this is all, I mean, I'll give these to you. So when you say, what would I like to do? I don't know what to do. Look at this. White South African couples say that they were attacked violently.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. That is the President of the United States with a pretty important meeting with the South African president last week, at which time, what Donald Trump does is has real conversations, whether it's Zelensky, whether it's with Schumer and Speaker Pelosi in his first term. When you come in with cameras, he does not need note cards. He has something he wants to say. He wants to listen. He will respond. But what about the truth? Some people think that he'd save South Africa by exposing, making them defend themselves about what his life is like right now if you're a white person in South Africa. Apartheid is evil. Got it. When Mandela moved South Africa forward, we thought we'd turn the page on that. I cannot give you the definitive history of South Africa government, but it looks pretty hellacious, and they seem to love their BRICS union. They love the Chinese, the Brazilians, and the Russians. Don't really seem too interested in relations with us, even though they're going to be hosting, I believe, the G20. Joining us now is Tony Leone. He's a former leader of the opposition of the Republic of South Africa, and he wrote a great column on Fox.com about Trump's criticism. Tony, first off, I'd be the first to tell you, I'm not an expert in South Africa. I've been hearing about these horrific stories. Was Donald Trump right in your mind to do what he did and challenge the president in the Oval Office?
Well, certainly by the standards of, good afternoon, Brian, normal diplomacy, it was very extraordinary. I actually was thinking that President Ramaphosa had been to the Oval Office before, and that was in 2022 in September, with Joe Biden, and no one took any notice. Well, the whole world took notice of the Trump-Ramaphosa showdown last Wednesday. So whether he was right or wrong, it's very unusual, and I think a deep sigh of relief was felt in South Africa by many people that we only got to sort of half Zelensky, I mean, in the sense that there was this public dressing down, but they did continue to a lunch afterwards, and apparently it was all more amiable at the lunch than it had been in the Oval Office. I wasn't there, of course, so I'm just relying on what people told me who were. I think the point is, Brian, that what President Trump said was, well, there's basically huge attacks on whites in South Africa. There is a huge crime problem in South Africa, and if you actually looked at the responses of the South African president, of the Minister of Agriculture, of Johan Rupert, who's a golfing friend of President Trump and also a billionaire, dollar billionaire, they were all saying, well, yes, it's not directed just at whites, it's across the whole of the country. And that is the essence of the problem. So I don't think there's what's been called a white, or clearly, if it's a white genocide, it's been a failure, since I'm speaking to you in relatively peaceful and prosperous circumstances from Cape Town in South Africa. And look, the majority of white people in South Africa still live pretty good middle-class lives. But the scourge of crime is there, and an enormous amount of redress. You in America would call it DEI. In South Africa, it's called Black Economic Empowerment or Employment Equity. And that certainly has been at the cost of some life chances and job opportunities for white people. And the reason given by the South African government is, well, we've got to undo 350 years of racial discrimination, which was directed by whites against blacks. So it's a kind of reversal of targets and roles.
Let me ask you this. Is it a reversal of targets for opportunities to buy a farm? Or, okay, reversal of targets where you have a farm and because there was apartheid, I want that farm and I'm black. Do I get that farm?
You don't get that farm. There's a very long-winded process. Look, the bureaucracy in South Africa is so terribly slow and often inefficient that you can make a claim if you were a black family or your predecessors were dispossessed under an apartheid law to get some kind of compensation. But I have to say, although I am completely against this latest expropriation act of the South African government and parliament, which incidentally was one of the reasons for President Trump's executive order against South Africa on the 7th of February, that there are no white farms that I'm aware of that there's been an arbitrary confiscation without recourse to law. So there's quite a lot of legislation, but it hasn't always been enacted. And even where it has been enacted, people here in South Africa still have redress to judicial processes in the event of a dispossession.
You're in Cape Town. Do you feel safe?
Look, Brian, I feel pretty safe, but I've got private, you know, security arrangements. Every South African middle-class person probably has access to ADT or pays for a service. We've got a guardhouse at the end of our road with private security people, and people live increasingly in gated communities. So the truth is, since 1994, when the ANC came to power, more than 650,000 South Africans have been murdered. I have to say, it's a horrific sum, that most of the victims are not whites, but black. Obviously, it's a much blacks are a much higher percentage of the population. So I don't think there's exemplary attention given by criminals to whites because they're white. I think there is, as indeed the South African government representatives who were with President Trump in the Oval Office last Wednesday made clear, there is a scourge of crime which the government has very ineffectively addressed, if it's addressed at all. And ironically, although there's a big debate back home where I'm speaking to you from now about, you know, the methodologies of President Trump last Wednesday, it suddenly highlighted a problem here and forced the government into taking, you know, saying they're going to take remedial and radical action. So maybe one of the unintended consequences when President Trump said, I don't know, was that he actually was forcing attention on a big problem in South Africa.
Tony Leon's our guest, former leader of the opposition party of the Republic of South Africa. So, Tony, what does kill the Boer mean?
Well, the defenders of that appalling song, which
I'm going to play it, but I just want you to tell everyone what that means first. Could you tell?
Well, kill the Boer means kill the farmer.
Okay.
Now, a former president of South Africa said, oh, it's just a chant, means nothing. But I can guarantee you one thing, that not only has this now been regarded as protected free speech in South Africa, if any white group in South Africa made a similar chant against the black population, there would be huge and consequential action. So it's not that, you know, in the sense of these incendiary comments and rhetoric and songs, that there's equal treatment. There isn't.
Yeah. So I want you to hear what Donald Trump, just picture the Oval Office, and he asked everyone to turn the lights down and listen to this leader. You probably know him. I don't. Cut 35.
Excuse me. Turn the lights down. Turn the lights down and just put this on. It's right behind you.
A revolution demands that at some point there must be killing, because the killing is part of a revolution.
To kill.
Killing is part of the revolution. Kill the Boer, kill the Boer, kill the Boer. And everyone goes crazy. So it.
Well, look,
and they say, well, that's the opposition leader. But it's not your party, right?
Well, no, it's certainly not. Look, it is an absolutely appalling rhetoric. It has no place or should have no standing in a democratic country like South Africa, which tells you where I think that some of the problems are. I need to say that party under that demagogic leader, who really is a black fascist, actually, Julius Malema, that they only got 9% in the last election. Now, my party, or the party I led, which is completely the opposite, it's market-friendly, it's non-racial, it's inclusive, got 22% of the votes in the last election. So you have a lot of radical politicians mouthing some pretty appalling rhetoric. But if you actually look at what the people of South Africa say, they are much more moderate and much more conservative than that kind of song, which doesn't suggest that this thing should be allowed, but it is allowed in South Africa. But it is hardly representative of mainstream opinion here.
Good. I mean, now you're going to host the G20. Do you guys want this attention? I mean, in a way,
you're probably speaking to the wrong guy here, Brian. I'm deeply skeptical about these political jamborees. I went on many myself, and I don't know how much they get. But I've made the point, and let me repeat it now to your listeners, that a G20 without the G1, and America is a G1 for all the reasons you know. It's by far the greatest economy, the biggest military, and South Africa's most important trading partner in terms of where we export goods to any one single country. We have huge trade with America. If Donald Trump, the president, is absent from the G20, it's a bit like playing Hamlet without the prince. It just becomes, I think, another talk fest without meaning. According to President Ramaphosa in his weekly newsletter, President Trump gave him a commitment over the lunch that they had after that Oval Office show that he is going to come to Johannesburg in November. And I'm sure, because President Trump speaks his mind, as I think the whole world knows, that he will use that platform to advance a very specific viewpoint, which perhaps, you know, needs to be heard in South Africa and in the wider world.
Yeah, so he's still up in the air. I guess it's 50-50 whether he's going. Tell me what you think of this analysis before you go. If this is Victor Davis Hanson, looking at what went down in the Oval Office. One thing, I love it. I think that we should have every president have real conversations, whether it's a friendship or rivalry. I think it respects the audience, the global audience, me and you. There's nothing scripted. Nobody has note cards. It's tell me about this. And if your answers are good, you're going to look great. And if they're not, then they're not. You're not going to like the answer. I like that realness. Here's Victor Davis Hanson, Cut 37.
Marco Rubio expelled the ambassador because he called Trump and the MAGA movement racist. They've called Israel, they're calling Israelis genocidal people. And they said they would arrest Netanyahu if he ever came into their jurisdiction. They sided with Putin in the Ukraine war. They facilitated a North Korean ship that was shipping arms. They're very anti-American, and they're angry now. I guess they're paranoid. They're just flabbergasted that under the previous Democratic administration, they had a free hand. They were as if they were Mandela recreated, and they weren't. But Donald Trump slapped a 34% tariff on them. He's threatening to perhaps get rid of their student visas. He's told them that they may not have access to the American market. And all of a sudden, they want to come over here and what? I don't know. Negotiate about what?
I mean, would you like to challenge any of his statements?
Well, some of those effects are incorrect. It wasn't a North Korean ship. It was a Russian ship, the Lady R. But you could say a distinction without a difference. So that wasn't correct. I actually think the South African position in the world, and I've been a stringent critic of it, I need to say, Brian, of many aspects of our policy, has to some extent been anti-Western, anti-American. On the other hand, they also want to be well-regarded and well-treated by Western governments, particularly the United States. And I think the fact that President Ramaphosa and his delegation sought an audience with President Trump underlines how significant South Africa now sees that relationship. I think the unfortunate part of some of the actions taken by the U.S. administration, for whatever reason, has been to cut off some pretty vital, life-giving situations here. We've got a program inaugurated by President George W. Bush, PEPFAR, which has really helped millions of people who are battling or seriously ill with AIDS. It just has just been cut off. So I think one must be fairly selective how you respond, even to what is seen as provocations coming out of the South African government. I think there is a distinction between what the government says in South Africa, what a lot of people in South Africa feel, and even within the government, where for the first time in recent history, my party, which is far more Western-oriented in its foreign policy, far more market-friendly, is now sitting in a coalition with Mr. Ramaphosa's party to keep out the extremist elements, such as the gentleman who was singing that song, Kill the Boer. So I think the situation here is not binary. I don't think it's black and white. I think it is relatively complex. And from my point of view, the more engagement America has with South Africa and South Africa has with America, the better for everyone.
Yeah, I guess we'll see, because one thing you got to do is the whole BRICS conference, which is a rival to, I guess, the G20, I guess it's a rival to, I don't know if it's a military alliance, but an economic alliance with India,
no,
Russia, China, Brazil.
And India.
They're talking about their own currency.
Incompatible alliance. Yeah. Well, they talk. But, I mean, you know, Brian, at the end of the day, I mean, there's an incompatibility of interests. You can have an organization with Iran and India and Brazil together with South Africa and China. It doesn't have a coherent position, a common platform. It has some areas of identity. I think the idea was to build up some counterweight in the world. But, you know, in the end of the day, countries must pursue their own interests. And the fact that South Africa is now responding to America by sending delegations, president, business people, means that the U.S.-South African relationship is actually very important to South Africa and to a lot of jobs here. I mean, you've got 600 U.S. companies here. You've got tens of thousands of jobs that, frankly, are dependent on American investment.
Thanks so much. It's fascinating. I'd be the first one to tell you, I don't know much about South Africa foreign policy. I saw Invictus, love the Mandela story. Everyone knows that. And then we just hear it's getting off the rails. But you helped our audience a lot. Tony Leon, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Brian.
Absolutely.
All the best. Bye-bye.
We'll do it again. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Democrats are in a huge bit of trouble. There's no way to look at this without recognizing the massive scale of our problems. And you can kind of tell yourself that things might be kind of okay by looking at just the shift from 20 to 24. But if you really want to assess where we are as a party, you have to look at the shift from 2016 to 2024.
Or 2012.
Even with Latino voters, actually, is the one group where Hillary Clinton in the Catalyst data did better than Obama. She 2 points better. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won 70% of Latino vote. Kamala Harris won 54%. It's a 16-point drop. And so the message I take from this is, anyone who thinks that we can get away with just tinkering around the edges, just hoping that Donald Trump becomes unpopular, they nominate some Yahoo in 2028, or we're going to ride the wave of tariffs and inflation to a narrow House victory, is just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Right. That's absolutely true. And the thing is, the Republicans have worked deliberately while dealing with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, and they thought they could ride that because they had state success in different elections. They and probably did save a few seats with that, with people who are pro-choice. But now they can't. And now it's up to the states, and we all know that. And if they're going to go roll that out again, good luck with that. It's not going to work. And they basically say, Rahm Emanuel said it, forget about the Democratic Party, the AOC and Bernie Sanders. Go get a big crowd. Congratulations. Look up oligarchy and tell me what you think of it. If the other people that are outside, like Senator Cuellar and others, Aguilar, I should say, and Rahm Emanuel, feel as though the way is through the middle. Don't forget, BrianKilmeade.com is the place to find out how to see me in Ohio, June 21st, History, Liberty, and Laughs, along with Fox Nation. Some tickets are still available. VIP opportunities remain. And then we got Richmond, Virginia in September and Dallas, Texas in August. Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.